number, given that the store had a special deal on flour, to stop and observe the commotion. Van Cleve blinked at the girl on the horse through his windshield, unsure at first who it was. He wound down his window.
"You properly lost your mind now, Alice?"
Alice glared at him. She dropped her reins, and her voice carried, clear as cut glass, through the still air, glittering with anger.
"You shot her dog?"
There was a brief silence.
"You shot Marjorie's dog?"
"I shot nothing."
She lifted her chin and looked steadily at him.
"No, of course you didn't. You wouldn't get your own hands dirty, would you? You probably got your men to come out here just to shoot that puppy."
She shook her head.
"My God, what kind of man are you?"
She saw then, from the questioning way Bennett swiveled to look at his father, that he hadn't known, and some small part of her was glad. Van Cleve, who had been open-mouthed, swiftly recovered his composure.
"You're crazy. Living with that O'Hare girl has turned you crazy."
He glanced out of his window, noting the neighbors who had stopped to listen, murmuring to each other. This was rich meat indeed for a quiet town. Van Cleve shot Marjorie O'Hare's dog.
"She's crazy. Look at her, riding her horse straight into my car, as if I'd shoot a dog."
He slapped his hands on the steering wheel. Alice didn't move. His voice rose a register.
"Me? Shoot a damn dog?"
And finally, when nobody moved and nobody spoke,
"Come on, Bennett. We got work to do."
He wrestled the wheel so that the car spun around her and accelerated briskly up the road, leaving Spirit to prance and shy as the gravel sprayed at her feet. It shouldn't have been a surprise. Sven leaned over the rough wooden table with Fred and the two women and relayed the tales coming out of Harlan County, of men dynamited clean out of their beds because of the escalating union disputes, of thugs with machine guns, of sheriffs turning the blindest of eyes. In the light of all this, a dead dog shouldn't have been much of a surprise, but it seemed to knock the fight right out of Marjorie. She'd been sick twice with the shock of it, and she cast around for her hound reflexively when they were home, her palm pressed to her cheek as if even now she half expected him to come bounding around the corner.
"Van Cleve's canny,"
muttered Sven as she left the room to check on Charlie, as she did repeatedly through each evening.
"He knew Marjorie wouldn't bat an eyelid if someone looked at her down the barrel of a gun, but if he picked off the things she loves..."
Alice considered this. "Are you worried, Sven?"
"For me? No. I'm a company man, and he needs a fire captain. I'm not unionized, but anything happens to me, all my boys go out. We're agreed on that. And if we walk, the mine shuts down. The sheriff might be in Van Cleve's pocket, but there are limits to what the state will tolerate."
He sniffed.
"Besides, this one's about him and you two girls, and he won't want attention drawn to the fact that he's engaged in a fight with a pair of women. Oh, no."
He took a slug of bourbon.
"He's just trying to spook you. But his men wouldn't hurt a woman. Even those thugs of his. They're bound by the code of the hills."
"What about the ones he's bringing in from out of state?"
said Fred.
"You sure they're bound by the code of the hills, too?"
Sven didn't seem to have an answer for that. Fred taught her how to use a shotgun. He showed her how to balance the stock and pull the butt against her shoulder, how to factor in the hefty kick backward when she lined up her sights, reminding her not to hold her breath, but to release the trigger as she breathed out slowly. The first time she pulled the trigger, he was standing close behind her, his hands on hers, and she bounced so hard against him that her face stayed pink for an hour. She was a natural, he told her, lining up cans on the fallen tree at the edge of Marjorie's land. Within days, she could pick them off like apples falling from a branch. At night, as she secured the new locks on the doors, Alice would run her hands along the barrel, lift it speculatively to her shoulder, firing imaginary rounds at unseen intruders coming up the track. She would pull the trigger for her friend. She had no doubt of that. Because something else had changed, too. Something fundamental. Alice had discovered how, for a woman at least, it was much easier to feel anger on behalf of someone you cared about, to access that cold burn, to want to make someone suffer if they had hurt someone you loved. Alice, it turned out, was no longer afraid. Chapter 14. Riding all winter, a librarian would wrap up so heavily it was hard to remember what she looked like underneath. Two vests, a flannel shirt, a thick sweater, and a jacket with maybe a scarf or two over the top. That was the daily uniform up in the mountains, perhaps with a pair of man's thick leather gloves over her own, a hat rammed low as she could get it, and another scarf pulled high over her nose so that her breath might bounce back and warm her skin a little. At home, she'd strip off reluctantly, revealing only the swiftest slice of bare skin to the elements between shedding undergarments and sliding, shivering, under her blankets. Aside from cloth washing, a woman working for the Packhorse Library could go for weeks without seeing her body much at all. Alice was still locked into her own private battle with the Van Cleves, although, thankfully, they seemed to have gone quiet for now. She could most often be found in the woods behind the cabin, practicing with Fred's old gun, the crack and zing of bullets hitting tin cans echoing through the still air. Izzy could be seen only in glimpses, trailing her mother miserably around town, and there were only intermittent appearances from Beth, the one person who could be relied on to notice these things, or joke about them, and she was mostly preoccupied with her arm and what she could and couldn't do. So nobody observed that Marjorie had put on a little weight, or thought to comment upon it. Sven, who knew Marge's body like he knew his own, understood the fluctuations that occurred in the female form, and enjoyed all of them equally, and was a wise enough man not to say anything. Marjorie herself had become accustomed to being bone-tired, trying to double up on roots, fighting every day to convince the disbelievers of the importance of stories, of facts, of knowledge. But this and the constant air of foreboding left her struggling each morning to lift her head from the pillow. The cold was etched into her after months of snow, and the long hours outside had left her permanently, ravenously hungry. So a woman could be excused for not noticing the things that other women might have picked up on faster, or, if she did, for sweeping the thought away under the larger pile of things she had to worry about. But there is always a point at which these things become impossible to ignore. One night in late February, Marjorie told Sven not to stop by, adding, with deceptive casualness, that she had a few things to catch up on. She helped Sophia with the last of the books, waved Alice off into the snowy night, and bolted the door behind her until it was just her alone in the little library. The log burner still glowed warm because Fred, God bless him, had packed it full of logs before he too disappeared to eat, his mind full of someone else entirely. She sat in the chair, her thoughts hanging low around her head in the darkness, until eventually she stood, pulled a heavy textbook from the shelf, and flicked through the pages until she found what she was looking for. Brow furrowed, she scanned the information carefully. She absorbed it, then counted off her fingers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5½. And then she did it a second time. Despite what people might have thought around Lee County about Marjorie O'Hare's family, about the kind of woman she must surely be, given where she came from, she was not prone to cursing. Now, however, she cursed softly, once, twice, and let her head sink silently into her hands. Chapter 15. The small-town bankers, grocers, editors, and lawyers, the police, the sheriff, if not the government, were all apparently subservient to the money and corporate masters of the area. It was their compulsion, if possibly not always their desire, to stand well with these who had the power to cause them material or personal difficulties. Theodore Dreiser, Introduction to Harlan Miners Speak.
Three families who wouldn't let me so much as hand over a book unless we read Bible stories. One slammed door up by those new houses near Hoffman, but Mrs. Cotter seems to have come back round now she understands we're not trying to tempt her into the ways of the flesh, and Doreen Abney says can she have the magazine with the recipe for the rabbit pie as she forgot to write it out 2 weeks ago.
Kathleen's saddlebag landed with a thump on the desk. She turned to look at Alice and rubbed dirt from her hands.
Oh, and Mr. Van Cleve stopped me in the street to tell me that we were an abomination, and the sooner we were gone from this town, the better. I'll show him abomination, said Beth darkly.
By mid-March, Beth had returned to work full-time, but nobody had the heart to tell Kathleen she was no longer needed. Mrs. Brady, who was a fair woman, if a little unbending, had declined to draw Izzy's wage since she had gone, and Marjorie simply handed the little brown paper packet directly to Kathleen. It was something of a relief, as she had been paying her out of her own pocket with the few savings she had hidden since her father's death. Twice, Kathleen's mother-in-law had come by the library to bring her children and show them what their mama was engaged in, her voice filled with pride. The children were great favorites among the women, who showed them the newest books and let them sit on the mule, and there was something in Kathleen's slow smile and the genuine warmth of her mother-in-law toward her that made everyone feel a little better. Realizing Alice would not be budged on the matter of returning to the house, Mr. Van Cleve had taken a new tack, insisting she leave town, that she wasn't wanted here, pulling alongside her in his car as she headed out on her early morning rounds so that Spirit's eyes rolled white and she pranced sideways to get away from the man bellowing out of the driver's window.
You got no way to support yourself, and that library's going to be finished in a matter of weeks. I've heard it from the governor's office himself. You ain't coming back to the house, then you'd best find somewhere else, somewhere back in England.
She had learned to ride with her face fixed straight ahead, as if she couldn't hear him, and this would enrage him more, so that he would invariably end up shouting halfway down the road, while Bennett slunk down in the passenger seat.
You ain't even all that pretty anymore!
Do you think Marjorie is really okay with me staying at the cabin? She would ask Fred afterward. I don't want to be in the way, but he's right. I don't have anywhere else to go.
Fred would bite his lip, as if he wanted to say something he couldn't.
I think Marjorie likes having you around. Like all of us,
he would answer carefully. She had started to notice new things about Fred. The confident way his hands rested on horses, the fluidity in the way he moved, not like Bennett, who, despite his athleticism, had always seemed uncomfortable, restrained by his own muscles, as if movement could only burst out of him sporadically. She found excuses to stay late in the cabin, helping Sophia, who kept her lips pursed. She knew. Oh, they all knew.
You like him, don't you?
Sophia asked her outright one night.
Me? Fred? Oh, my,
she stammered.
He's a good man.
Sophia had said it with the emphasis on good, as if she were comparing him to someone else.
Were you ever married, Sophia?
Me? No.
Sophia raised a thread to her teeth and bit it through neatly. And just at the point where Alice wondered if she had yet again been too direct, she added,
Loved a man once. Benjamin. A miner. He was best friends with William. We knew each other since we were children.
She held her stitching up to the lamp.
But he's dead now.
Did he die in the mines?
No. Some men shot him. He was minding his business. Just walking home from work.
Oh, Sophia, I'm so sorry.
Sophia's expression was unreadable, as if she had had years of practice of hiding what she felt.
I couldn't stay here for a long time. Took myself off to Louisville and put all my heart into working at the Colored Library there. Built something of a life, though I missed him every day. When I heard William had suffered his accident, I prayed to God not to make me come back here. But you know, he has his ways.
Is it still difficult?
It was at first, but
she shrugged.
Things change. Ben died 14 years ago now. The world moves on.
Do you think you'll ever meet anyone else?
Oh, no. That ship has sailed. Besides, I don't fit nowhere. Too educated for most of the men around here. My brother would say too opinionated.
Sophia laughed.
That sounds familiar, said Alice, and sighed. I got William for company. We get by. And I'm hopeful. Things are good.
She smiled.
Got to count your blessings. I enjoy my job. I got friends here now. That's a little how I feel, too.
Almost on impulse, Sophia reached out a slim hand and squeezed Alice's. Alice squeezed back, struck by the unexpected comfort of a human touch. They held each other's grip tightly, and then, almost reluctantly, released it.
I do think he's kind, said Alice after a moment. And quite handsome.
Girl, all you'd have to do is say the word. That man's been pining after you like a dog after a bone since the day I got here.
But I can't, can I?
Sophia looked up.
Half the town thinks this library is a hotbed of immorality, and me at the heart of it. Can you imagine what they'd say about us if I took up with a man who wasn't my husband?
She had a point, Sophia told William afterward. Just seemed a damn shame, two good people, so glad to be in each other's company.
Well, said William, nobody ever said this world was going to be fair.
Ain't that the truth,
said Sophia, and returned to her stitching, briefly lost in the memory of a man with an easy laugh who had never failed to make her smile, and the long-lost weight of his arm around her waist.
She's a schoolmistress, old spirit,
Fred said as they rode home in the encroaching dusk. He was wearing a heavy oilcloth jacket to keep off the thin rain, and the green scarf the librarians had bought him for Christmas was wrapped around his neck, as it had been every day since they'd given it to him.
You see it today? Every time this one spooked, she gave him a look as if to say, you get a hold of yourself. And when he didn't listen, her ears went flat back. She's telling him all right.
Alice watched the two horses walking side by side and marveled at the tiny differences Fred could distinguish. He could assess a horse's conformation, sucking his teeth at sloping shoulders or cow hocks or an underdeveloped top line, when all Alice saw was nice horsey. He could assess their characters, too. They were pretty much who they were from birth, as long as men didn't muck them up too much, he said.
Course, most couldn't help themselves.
She was often left with the impression that when Fred said these things, he was talking about something else entirely. He had taken to meeting her along her routes on a young thoroughbred with a scarred ear, Pirate. He said it was helpful to have the young horse work alongside Spirit's more level temperament, but she suspected he had other reasons for being there, and she didn't mind. It was hard enough being alone with her thoughts most of the day.
Did you finish the hardy?
Fred screwed up his face.
I did. Couldn't warm to that angel character, though.
No?
Found myself kind of wanting to give him a kick half the time. There she was, that poor girl, just wanting to love him. And him like some kind of preacher, judging her. Even though none of it was her fault. And then at the end, he goes and marries her sister.
Alice stifled a laugh.
I'd forgotten that bit.
They talked of books they had recommended to each other. She had quite enjoyed the Mark Twain, found the George Herbert poems unexpectedly moving. Lately, it had seemed easier for them to talk about books than anything in real life.
So, can I give you a ride home?
They had reached the library and turned the horses into Fred's barn for the night.
It's awful wet to be walking all the way up to Marge's. I could drive you as far as the big oak.
Oh, but it was tempting. The long walk in the dark was the worst part of the day, a point at which she was hungry and aching and her mind had nowhere good to settle. There was a time when she might have ridden Spirit and kept her there overnight, but they had an unspoken agreement not to keep any other animals at the cabin just now. Fred had closed up the barn and was looking at her expectantly. She thought of the quiet pleasure of sitting alongside him, of watching his strong hands on the wheel, his smile as he told her things in small bursts, confidences offered up like shells in the palm of his hand.
I don't know, Fred. I can't really be seen.
Well, I was thinking.
He shifted on his feet a little.
I know you like to allow Marjorie and Sven a little space together, and right now more than most.
Something odd was going on with Marjorie and Sven. It had taken her a week or two to notice, but the little cabin was no longer filled with the muffled cries of lovemaking. Sven was often gone before Alice rose in the morning, and when he was there, there were no whispered jokes or casual intimacies, but stiff silences and loaded glances. Marjorie seemed preoccupied. Her face was set stern and her manner short. The previous evening, though, when Alice had asked her if she would rather she left, the woman's face had softened. Then she had responded quite unexpectedly, not by telling her dismissively that she was fine and not to fuss, but by saying quietly,
"No, please don't leave."
A lover's tiff? She would not betray her friend by talking about her private business, but she felt utterly at a loss.
So I was wondering if you would like to have some food with me. I'd be happy to cook, and I could—
She dragged her attention back to the man in front of her.
Have you back at the cabin by 8:30 or thereabouts?
Fred, I can't.
He closed his mouth abruptly over his words.
It's not that I wouldn't like to, it's just, if I was seen, well, things are tricky just now. You know how this town talks.
He looked like he had half expected it.
I can't risk making things worse for the library, or for myself. Perhaps when things have calmed down a little.
Even as she said the words, she realized she wasn't sure how that would work. This town could polish a piece of gossip and preserve it like an insect in amber. It would still be rolling around whole centuries later.
Sure,
he said.
Well, just wanted you to know the offer's there, in case you get tired of Marjorie's cooking.
He tried to laugh, and they stood facing each other, each a little awkward. He broke it, raised his hat in greeting, and trudged back up the wet path to his house. Alice stood watching, thinking of the warmth inside, the blue rag rug, the sweet smell of the polished wood. And then she sighed, pulled her scarf over her nose, and began the long walk up the cold mountain to Marjorie's. Sven knew that Marjorie was not a woman who would be pushed, but when she told him it would be best if he stayed at his own house for the third time that week, he could no longer ignore the feeling in his gut. Watching her unsaddle Charlie, he found himself crossing his arms and observing her with cooler, assessing eyes until finally he uttered the words he'd been mulling over for weeks.
Have I done something, Marge?
What?
And there it was again, the way she would barely look at him when she spoke.
Seems like the last few weeks you barely want me around.
You're talking crazy.
I can't seem to say nothing to please you. When we go to bed, you're bundled up like a silkworm. Don't want me to touch you?
He stuttered, faltering uncharacteristically.
We've never been cold with each other, even when we were apart. Not in 10 years. I just want to know if I've
done something to offend you.
Her shoulders slumped a little. She reached under the horse for his girth and flipped it over the saddle, the buckle jangling as it landed. There was something weary in the way she did it that reminded him of a mother dealing with ill-behaved children. She allowed a short silence before she spoke.
You've done nothing to offend me, Sven. I'm just tired. So why don't you want me even to hold you?
Well, I don't always want to be held.
You never used to mind.
Disliking the sound of his voice, he took the saddle from her and walked it over to the house. She turned Charlie loose into his stall, rugged him, bolted the barn door, and followed in silence. They locked everything these days, their eyes sharp for change, ears tuned to any strange sound around the holler. The track up from the road was strewn with a series of strings set with bells and tin cans to give her fair warning, and two loaded shotguns flanked the bed. He placed the saddle on its stand and stood, thinking. Then he took a step toward her, lifted a hand, and touched the side of her face softly, an olive branch. She didn't look up. Before, she would have pressed his palm to her skin and kissed it. The fact of this made something plummet inside him.
We've always been straight with each other, haven't we? Sven, I respect how you want to live. I accepted that you don't want to be tied. I haven't so much as mentioned it since...
She rubbed at her forehead.
Can we not do this now? What I mean is, we agreed. We agreed that if you did decide you didn't want me anymore, you would say.
Are we on this again?
Marjorie sounded sad and exasperated. She turned away from him.
It's not you. I don't want you to go anywhere. I just got a lot to think about.
We've all got a lot to think about.
She shook her head.
Marjorie.
And there she stood, mulish as Charlie, giving him nothing. Sven Gustafsson was not a man possessed of a difficult temperament, but he was proud and he had his limits.
I can't keep doing this. I'm not going to keep bothering you.
She raised her head as he turned.
You know where to find me when you're ready to see me again.
He held up one hand as he walked off down the mountain. He didn't look back. Sophia was off on Friday, as it was William's birthday, and given they were up to date with the repairs, possibly due to Alice's spending so much extra time at the library, Marjorie had urged her to stay with her brother. Alice rode up Split Creek as dusk fell, noting that the light was still on, and wondered, given Sophia's absence, which of the librarians was still inside. Beth was always swift to finish, dumping her books and racing home to the farm. If she didn't get there quick enough, her brothers would have eaten whatever food had been put by for her. Kathleen was equally keen to get home, to catch her children's last waking moments before bedtime. It was only she and Izzy who kept their horses at Fred's barn, and Izzy, it appeared, was gone from the project for good. Alice unsaddled Spirit and stood for a minute in the warmth of the stall, then kissed the mare's sweet-smelling ears, pressing her face against her warm neck and finding treats for her when she nuzzled her pockets with her soft, inquisitive nose. She loved the animal now, knew her traits and strengths as well as she knew her own. The little horse was, she realized, the most constant relationship in her life. When she was sure the mare was comfortable, she headed for the back door of the library, from which she could still see a sliver of light through the unpapered gaps in the wood.
Marge? She called.
Well, you sure do take your time.
Alice blinked at the sight of Fred, seated at a little table in the middle of the room, dressed in a clean flannel shirt and blue jeans.
Took your point about not being seen with me in public, but I thought maybe we could have a meal together anyway.
Alice closed the door behind her, taking in the neatly laid table with a little vase of coltsfoot, harbinger of spring, in the center, the two chairs and the oil lamps flickering on the desks nearby, sending shadows over the spines of the books around them. He seemed to take her shocked silence for reticence.
It's just pork and black bean stew. Nothing too fancy. I wasn't sure what time you'd make it back. The greens may have cooled a little. I didn't realize you'd be so thorough with that horse of mine.
He lifted the lid off the heavy iron pot, and the room was suddenly filled with the scent of slow-cooked meat. Beside her on the table sat a heavy pan of cornbread and a bowl of green beans. Alice's stomach gurgled unexpectedly and loudly, and she pressed a hand to it, trying not to blush.
"Well, someone approves,"
Fred said evenly. He stood and walked over to pull out a chair for her. She put her hat on the desk and unwound her scarf.
"Fred, I
know. But I enjoy your company, Alice. And being a man in these parts, I don't get to entertain someone like you too often."
He leaned toward her to pour her a glass of wine.
"So I'd be much obliged if you'd indulge me."
She opened her mouth to protest, then found she wasn't sure what she was protesting. When she looked up, he was watching her, waiting for a sign. "This all looks wonderful," she said. He let out a little breath then, as if perhaps even up to that point he had not been sure whether she would cut and run. And then, as he began to serve the food, he smiled, a slow, broad smile that was so filled with satisfaction she couldn't help but smile back at him. The Packhorse Library had become, in the months of its existence, a symbol of many things and a focus for others. Some controversial, and some that would provoke unease in certain people however long it stayed around. But for one freezing, damp evening in March, it became a tiny, glowing refuge. Two people locked safely inside, briefly released from their complicated histories and the weighty expectations of the town around them, ate good food and laughed. And discussed poetry and stories, horses, and mistakes they had made, and while there was barely a touch between them, apart from the accidental brushing of skin against skin while passing bread or refilling a glass, Alice rediscovered a little part of her that she hadn't known she missed. The flirtatious young woman who liked to talk about things she had read, seen, and thought about as much as she liked to ride a mountain track. In turn, Fred enjoyed a woman's full attention, a ready laugh at his jokes, and the challenge of an idea that might differ from his own. Time flew, and each ended the night full and happy, with the rare glow that comes from knowing your very being has been understood by somebody else, and that there might just be someone out there who will only ever see the best in you. Fred lifted the table easily down the last of the steps, ready to move it back into his house, then turned back to double lock the door. Alice stood beside him, wrapping her scarf around her face, her belly full and a smile on her lips. Both were shielded from view by the library, and somehow found themselves standing just inches apart.
"You sure you won't let me drive you back up the mountain? It's cold and dark, and that's a long walk."
She shook her head.
"It'll feel like 5 minutes tonight."
He studied her in the half-light.
"You ain't spooked by much these days, are you?"
"No."
"That'll be Marjorie's influence."
They smiled at each other, and he looked briefly thoughtful.
"Wait there."
He jogged up to the house and returned a minute later with a shotgun, which he handed to her.
"Just in case," he said. "You might not be spooked, but it'll allow me to rest easy. Bring it back tomorrow."
She took it from him without protest, and there followed a strange, elongated couple of minutes, the kind in which two people know they have to part and don't want to, and while neither can acknowledge it, each believes the other feels it too.
"Well," she said at last, "it's getting late."
He rubbed his thumb speculatively across the tabletop, his mouth closed over words he could not say.
"Thank you, Fred. It was honestly the nicest evening I've had, probably since I came here. I really appreciate it."
A look passed between them that was a complicated mixture of things, an acknowledgement of the kind that might normally make a heart sing, but cut with the knowledge that some things were impossible and that your heart could break a little knowing it. And suddenly, a little of the magic of the evening dissipated.
Good night, then, Alice.
Good night, Fred, she said.
Then, placing the gun over her shoulder, she turned and strode up the road before he could say anything that would make more of a mess of things than they already were. Chapter 16. That's the one trouble with this country. Everything, weather, all, hangs on too long. Like our rivers, our land, opaque, slow, violent, shaping and creating the life of man in its implacable and brooding image. William Faulkner, As I Lay Dying. The rain came late into March, first turning the frozen sidewalks and stones into skating rinks, and then, through sheer relentlessness, obliterating the snow and ice on the lower ground in an endless gray sheet. There was limited pleasure to be found in the slight lifting of temperatures, the prospect of warmer days ahead, because it didn't stop. After 5 days, the rain had turned the unfinished roads to mud, or in some places, washed away the top layers completely, revealing sharp boulders and holes on the surface that would catch the unwary. Waiting horses stood tethered outside, their heads low and resigned, their tails clamped to their hindquarters, and cars bucked and growled along the slippery mountain roads. Farmers muttered in the feed store, while the shopkeepers observed that the Lord only knew why that much water was still hanging up there in the heavens. Marjorie arrived back from her 5 a.m. round, soaked to her socks, to find the librarian sitting with steepled fingers and fidgeting feet with Fred.
"Last time it rained like this, the Ohio burst its banks," said Beth, peering out of the open door, from where you could hear the gurgle of surface water as it made its way down the road. She took a last drag of her cigarette and ground it under the heel of her boot.
"Too wet to ride, that's for sure," said Marjorie. "I'm not taking Charlie out again."
Fred had looked out first thing and warned Alice it was a bad idea, and though there was little that would normally stop her, she took him seriously. He had moved his own horses up onto high land, where they could just be seen in a slick, wet huddle.
"I'd put them in the barn," he had told her as she helped him walk the last two up, "but they're safer up there."
His father had once lost an entire locked barn of mares and foals when Fred was a boy. The river had flooded while the family was sleeping, and by the time they woke, only the hayloft was still above water. His father had wept in telling him, the only time Fred had ever seen that happen. He told Alice of the great flood the previous year, how water had flipped whole houses and sent them downriver, of how many people died, and how they had found a cow wedged 25 feet up in a tree when the waters receded and had to shoot it to put it out of its misery. Nobody could work out how to get it down. The four of them sat in the library for an hour, nobody keen to leave, yet with nothing to be there for. They talked of misdeeds they'd performed as children, of the best bargains to be had in animal feed, of a man three of them knew who could whistle tunes through a missing tooth and add his voice to become a one-man orchestra. They talked about how if Izzy were here, she would have sung them a song or two. But the rain grew heavier, and slowly the conversation ebbed away, and they were all left glancing at the door with a creeping sense of foreboding.
"What do you think, Fred?"
Marjorie broke the silence.
"I don't like it."
"Me neither."
At that moment, they heard the sound of horses' hooves. Fred strode to the door, perhaps concerned it might be an escapee, but it was the mailman, water sluicing from the brim of his hat.
"The river's rising and fast. We need to warn people on the creek beds, but there's no one at the sheriff's office."
Marjorie turned to Beth and Alice.
"I'll get the bridles," said Beth.
Izzy was so deep in thought that she didn't notice when her mother took the embroidery off her lap and tutted loudly.
Oh, Izzy, I'm going to have to unpick all those stitches. That's nothing like the pattern whatsoever. What have you been doing?
Mrs. Brady dragged a copy of Woman's Home Companion to her lap and flicked through until she found the pattern she was looking for.
Absolutely nothing like it. Why, you've done running stitch where it should be a chain stitch.
Izzy dragged her attention to the sampler.
I hate sewing. You never used to mind it. I don't know what's got into you lately.
Izzy didn't rise to it, which made Mrs. Brady tut more loudly.
I've never met a girl more out of sorts. You know very well what's got into me. I'm bored, and I'm stuck here, and I can't bear that you and Daddy have been swayed by an idiot like Jeffrey Van Cleve. That's no way to talk. Why don't you do some quilting? You used to enjoy it. I have some lovely old fabrics in my chest upstairs, and I miss my horse. He was not your horse.
Mrs. Brady closed her mouth and took a diplomatic moment before she opened it again.
But I was thinking we could perhaps buy you one if you think horseback riding is something you'd like to pursue. For what? To go around and around in circles? To make it look pretty like a stupid doll? I miss my job, Mother, and I miss my friends. I had real friends for the first time in my life. I was happy at the library. Doesn't that mean anything to you? Well, now you're just being dramatic.
Mrs. Brady sighed and sat down on the settle beside her daughter.
Look, dear, I know how you love singing. Why don't I talk to your father about some proper lessons? We could perhaps find out if there's anybody in Lexington who might help you work on your voice. Perhaps when Daddy hears how good you are, he'll change his mind. Oh, Lord, though, we'll have to wait until this rain eases. Have you ever seen anything like it?
Izzy didn't answer. She sat by the parlor window, gazing out at the blurred view.
You know, I think I'm going to telephone your father. I'm anxious the river will flood. I lost good friends in the Louisville floods, and I haven't felt the same about the river since. Why don't you unpick that last bit of stitching, and we'll go back over it together?
Mrs. Brady disappeared into the hallway, and Izzy could hear her dialing her father's office, the low murmur of her voice. Izzy stared out of the window at the gray skies, her finger tracing the rivulets that zigzagged down the pane, squinting at a horizon that was no longer visible.
Well, your father thinks we should stay put. He says we might call Carrie Anderson in old Louisville and see if she and her family want to rest here a day or two, just in case. Lord knows what we'll do with all those little dogs of hers, though. I don't think we could cope with the... Izzy? Izzy?
Mrs. Brady spun around in the empty parlor.
Izzy? Are you upstairs?
She walked down the hall and through the kitchen, where the maid turned from her dough rolling, nonplussed, and shook her head. And then, Mrs. Brady saw the back door, the inside slick with raindrops. Her daughter's leg brace lay on the tiled floor, and her riding boots were gone. Marjorie and Beth trotted hard down Main Street, a blur of hoofs and spraying water. Around them, the unfinished road sent water sweeping down the hill and over their feet, while gutters gurgled, protesting against the weight of it. They rode with their heads low and their collars up, and when they got to the verges, they cantered, the horses' feet sinking into the boggy grass. At the lower reaches of Spring Creek, they split to each side of the road and dismounted, running to each front door and hammering on it with wet fists.
"Water's rising!"
they yelled as the horses pulled back on their reins.
Get to higher ground!
Behind them, a straggle of occupants began to move, faces peering around doors, out of windows, trying to work out how seriously to take this instruction. By the time they were a quarter mile down the road, some behind them had begun hoisting furniture to the top floors of those houses that were double-storied, the rest loading wagons or trucks with what might be protected.
Tarpaulins were thrown over the backs of open vehicles, small, querulous children wedged between gray-faced adults. People in Baileyville had had enough experience of floods to know that they were a threat to be taken seriously. Marjorie hammered on the last door of Spring Creek, water plastering her hair to her face.
Mrs. Cornish? Mrs. Cornish?
A woman in a wet headscarf appeared at the door, waves of agitation rising off her.
Oh, thank goodness. Marjorie, dear, I can't get my mule.
She turned and ran, motioning to them to follow. The mule was at the bottom of his paddock, which backed onto the creek. The lowest slopes, boggy on the driest of days, were now a thick slick of toffee-colored mud, and the little brown and white mule stood immobile, apparently resigned, up to his chest in it.
He can't seem to budge. Please help him.
Marjorie pulled at his halter. Then, when that made no difference, she placed her weight against him, trying to tug at a lone foreleg. The mule lifted his muzzle, but no other part of him moved.
You see?
Mrs. Cornish's gnarly old hands wrung together.
He's stuck fast.
Beth ran to the other side and tried her best, too, slapping on his rear end, yelling, and placing her shoulder against him, to no effect. Marjorie stepped back and looked over at Beth, who gave a small shake of her head. She tried again with her shoulder against him, but apart from his ears flicking, not a part of the mule moved. Marjorie stopped, thinking.
I can't leave him.
We're not going to leave him, Mrs. Cornish. You got your harness? And some rope? Beth, come here. Mrs. Cornish, hold Charlie for me, will you?
As the rain beat down, the two younger women ran for the harness, then waded back to the mule. The water had risen even since they had arrived, creeping upward across the grass. Where for months it had been a sweet-sounding trickle, a sunlit brook, now it rushed in a wide, unforgiving yellow torrent. Marjorie slid the harness over the mule's head and fastened the buckles, her fingers slipping on the wet straps. The rain roared in their ears so that they had to yell at each other and point to be understood, but months of working alongside each other had granted them a shorthand. Beth did the same on the other side until both shouted, "Done!" They buckled the traces to the surcingle, then looped the rope through the brass hook at his shoulder. Not many mules would tolerate a strap from their girth running through their legs, but Charlie was smart and needed to be reassured just once. Beth attached her traces to her horse Scooter's breastplate, and in unison, each began to urge their animal forward along the less waterlogged ground.
Go on, Charlie, now! Go on, Scooter!
The animal's ears flicked, Charlie's eyes widening uncharacteristically as he felt the unfamiliar dead weight behind him. Beth urged him and Scooter forward while Marjorie tugged at the rope, yelling encouragement at the little mule, which flailed, his head bobbing as he felt himself being pulled forward.
That's it, fella. You can do it.
Mrs. Cornish crouched on the other side of him, two broad planks laid on the mud in front of his chest, ready to give him something to brace against.
Come up, boys!
Marjorie turned, saw Charlie and Scooter straining, their flank shivering with effort as they dug into the ground in front, stumbling, mud clods flying up around them, and realized with dismay that the mule really was stuck fast. If Charlie and Scooter kept digging down with their hoofs like that, they would be stuck soon, too. Beth looked at her, her own mind already there. She grimaced.
We gotta leave him, Marge. Water's coming up real fast.
Marjorie placed a hand on the little mule's cheek.
We can't leave him.
They turned toward a shout. Two farmers were running toward them from the houses further back. Solid, middle-aged men Marjorie knew only by sight from the corn market, in overalls and oilcloths. They didn't say a word, just slid down beside the mule and began hauling at the harness along with Charlie and Scooter, boots braced against the earth, their bodies at a 45-degree angle.
Go on! Go on, boys!
Marjorie joined them, put her head down, placing her whole weight against the rope. An inch. Another inch.
A terrible sucking sound, and then the little mule's near front leg was freed. His head lifted in surprise, and the two men hauled again in unison, grunting with the effort, their muscles bulging against the rope. Charlie and Scooter staggered in front of them, heads low, hind legs quivering with the effort, and suddenly, with a lurch, the mule was up, flipped on his side, and pulled along the muddy grass a couple of feet before Charlie and Scooter knew to stop. His eyes were wide with surprise, and his nostrils flared before he stumbled to his feet so that the men had to leap backward out of his way. Marjorie barely had time to thank them. The briefest of nods, a tip to a wet hat brim, and they were gone, running back through the deluge to their own homes to retrieve what they could. Marjorie experienced a brief moment of pure love for the people she had grown up alongside, those who would not see a man or a mule struggle alone. "Is he okay?" she yelled at Mrs. Cornish, who was running her weathered hands down the mule's mud-covered legs.
"He's good," she shouted back. "You need to get to higher ground." "I can take it from here, girls. You get on now."
Marjorie winced suddenly at a complaint from some previously unknown muscle in her belly. She hesitated, doubled over, then stumbled toward Charlie as Beth unhooked the traces.
"Where next?"
Beth yelled, hoisting herself aboard the skittering scooter, and Marjorie, winded from the effort of climbing back aboard Charlie, had to bend over a minute and catch her breath before she answered.
"Sophia," she said suddenly. "I'm going to check on Sophia. If this place is flooding, then Sophia and Williams will be too. You head for the houses across the creek."
Beth nodded, wheeled her horse around, and was gone. Kathleen and Alice loaded the wheelbarrow with books, covering them with sacking so that Fred could push it up the soaking path toward his home. They had only one barrow, and the women would load it as swiftly as they could, carrying the books in stacks toward the back door, then following him, laden with as many other books as they could fit into four saddlebags, knees buckling under the weight, heads bowed against the weather. They had cleared maybe a third of the library in the past hour, but since then, the water had risen to the second step, and Alice was afraid they wouldn't manage much more before it rose right over.
"You okay?"
Fred passed Alice on the track back down. He was wrapped in oilcloth, and a trail of water ran from the side of his hat.
"I think Kathleen should leave. She shouldn't be away from her children."
Fred looked up at the skies, then down the road, where the mountains disappeared in a blur of gray.
"Tell her to go," he said.
"But what will you do?" said Kathleen minutes later. "You can't move all these, just the two of you."
"We'll save what we can. You need to go home."
When she hesitated again, Fred put his hand on her upper arm.
"They're just books, Kathleen."
She didn't protest a second time. She just nodded, mounted Garrett's horse, and swung round, cantering back up the road so that sprays of water shot out behind her. They rested a moment and stood briefly in the dry of the cabin, watching her go, their chests heaving with the effort. Water dripped off their oilcloth coats into pools on the wooden floor.
"You sure you're okay, Alice? It's heavy work."
"I'm stronger than I look."
"Well, that's the truth."
They exchanged a small smile. Almost without thinking, Fred lifted a hand and slowly wiped a droplet of rain from under her eye with his thumb. Alice was briefly stilled by the electric shock of his skin on hers, by the unexpected intensity of his pale gray eyes, his lashes soaked into shining black points. She had the strangest urge to take his thumb into her mouth and bite it. Their eyes locked, and she felt her breath pushed from her lungs, her face coloring as if he could read her mind.
"Can I help?"
They sprang apart at the sight of Izzy in the doorway, her mother's car parked haphazardly up against the rail, her riding boots in her hand. The roaring of the rain on the tin roof had muffled the sound of her arrival.
"Izzy!"
Alice's voice emerged in an embarrassed rush, too high, too shrill. She stepped forward impulsively and embraced her.
"Oh, how we've missed you. Look, Fred, it's Izzy." came to see if I could help, said Izzy, blushing.
That's good news.
Fred was about to speak, then looked down and realized she was not wearing her leg brace.
You ain't going to be able to walk the track, are you?
Not very fast, she said.
Okay, let me think. You drove that thing here?
He said, incredulous.
Izzy nodded. Not too good on the clutch with my left leg, but if I lean on it with my stick, I'm fine.
Fred's eyebrows shot up, but he swiftly lowered them.
Marjorie and Beth have taken the routes nearer the south side of town. Take the car as far up to the school as you can, and tell them on the other side of the creek that they need to get to higher ground. But go across the footbridge. Don't try to drive that thing across the water, okay?
Izzy ran for the car, her arms sheltering her head, and climbed in, trying to make sense of what she had just seen. Fred, cradling Alice's face tenderly in his hand, the two of them just inches apart. She felt, suddenly, like she had done at school, never quite party to whatever was going on, and pushed the thought away, trying to smother it in the memory of Alice's delight at seeing her. Izzy, we've missed you. For the first time in a month, Izzy Brady felt something like herself again. She rammed her stick down onto the clutch, hauled the car into reverse, spun it round, and set off for the far end of town, a determined jut to her chin, a woman, once again, with a mission. Monarch Creek was already under a foot of water by the time they reached it. This was one of the lowest points of the county. There was a reason that this land had mostly been left to colored folk. It was lush, yes, but prone to flooding. Mosquitoes and no-see-ums were thick in the air through the months of summer. Now, as Charlie clattered down the hill through the sheeting rain, Marjorie could just make out Sophia, a wooden box atop her head, wading through the waters, her dress floating around her. A pile of her and William's belongings sat on the slopes of the patch of woodland above. From the doorway, William looked out, his face anxious, his wooden crutch wedged under his armpit.
"Oh, thank the Lord!" Sophia yelled as Marjorie approached. "We need to save our things!"
Marjorie jumped off the mule and ran toward the house, heading into the water. Sophia had rigged up a rope between the porch and a telegraph pole by the road, and Marjorie now used this to make her way across the creek. The water was icy, and the current ominously strong, although it only came to her knees. Inside the house, Sophia's cherished furniture had toppled over, the smaller items bobbing in the water. Marjorie found herself momentarily paralyzed. What to save? She grabbed for photographs on the wall, for books and ornaments, wedging them into her coat and reaching out for a side table, which she hauled to the doorway and out onto the grass. Her belly ached, the pain low in her pelvis, and she found herself wincing.
"You can't save no more," she yelled at Sophia. "Water's coming up too fast. That's everything we own in there."
Sophia's voice was despairing. Marjorie bit her lip.
"One more trip, then."
William was moving around the flooded room, using his arms to support himself on the wall, trying to corral essentials, a pan, a chopping board, two bowls, clasping them in his huge hands.
"That rain easing off any?"
he said, but his face suggested he already knew the answer.
"It's time to get out, William," she said.
"Let me just fetch a couple more."
How do you tell a proud amputee he can be of no help? How do you tell him the mere fact of him being in there is not just a hindrance, but likely to put them all at risk? Marjorie bit back her words and reached for Sophia's embroidery box, wedging it under her arm and wading outside, where she grabbed a wooden chair from the porch with her other, hauling them up to dry land, grunting with the effort. Then the pile of blankets, ported high above her head. Lord knew how they were going to dry those out. She looked down, feeling the sharp protest again from her womb. The water was now up to her crotch, her long coat swirling around her thighs. 3 inches higher in the last 10 minutes?
"We gotta go!"
she yelled as Sophia, her head down, made her way back in.
No time!
Sophia nodded, her face pained. Marjory made it out of the water, feeling it drag at her, shifting and insistent. Up on the bank, Charlie shifted nervously, his reins taut against the pole, signaling his own desire to be far from there. He didn't like water, never had, and she took a second to soothe him.
I know, fella. You're doing so good.
Marjory placed the last of Sophia's items on the pile, pulling the tarpaulin over them, and wondering whether she could move any of it further up the hill. Something fluttered deep inside, and she was startled until she realized what it was. She stopped and placed her hand upon her belly, feeling it again, flooded with an emotion she couldn't identify.
Marjory!
She spun around to see Sophia clutching at William's sleeve. There appeared to have been some kind of surge, and she was now up to her waist. The water, Marjory saw, had turned black.
Oh, Lord, she murmured.
Stay there!
Sophia and William had stepped down gingerly onto the underwater steps, one hand each gripping the rope. Sophia's free arm tight around her brother's waist. The inky water rushed past them, its force sending a strange energy into the air. William's eyes were down, his knuckles taut as he tried to steer his crutch forward through the swollen river. Marjory half ran, half stumbled down the hill, her eyes on them as they made their way toward her.
Keep coming! You can make it!
She yelled, skidding to a stop at the edge. And then, snap! The rope gave way, sending both Sophia and William off their feet and flinging them downstream. Sophia shrieked. She was thrown forward, her arms out, disappeared for a moment, and then, emerging, managed to grab hold of a bush, her hands closing tight around its branches. Marjory ran alongside her, her heart in her throat. She threw herself down on her belly and grabbed hold of Sophia's wet wrist. Sophia switched her grip to Marjorie's other wrist, and after a second, Marjory had hauled her up the bank, where she collapsed backward, and Sophia crouched on her muddied hands and knees, her clothes black and sodden, panting with the effort.
William!
Marjory turned at Sophia's voice to see William half-submerged, his face screwed up with effort as he tried to haul himself back along the rope. His crutch had disappeared, and the water was around his waist.
I can't get through, he yelled.
Can he swim? No,
wailed Sophia. Marjory ran for Charlie, her wet clothes dragging at every step. Somewhere she had lost her hat, and the water sent her hair cascading over her face so that she had to keep pushing it back to see.
Okay, boy,
she murmured, unhooking Charlie's reins from the pole.
I need you to help me now.
She pulled him down the bank and to the water, where she waded in, her free hand out to the side to steady her, her boots testing the ground for obstacles. He stalled at first, his ears flat back and his eyes white, but at her urging, he took a tentative step and then another, and, huge ears flicking forward and back at the sound of her voice, he was splashing his way through, beside Marjory, pushing against the torrent. William was gasping by the time they reached him, both hands on the rope as he scrabbled for purchase. He grabbed blindly at Marjory, his face a mask of panic, and she yelled to be heard above the sound of the water.
Just hold him round his neck, William, okay? Wrap your arms around his neck!
William held on to the mule, his great body pressed against Charlie's, and, groaning with the effort, Marjory turned the two of them in the depths of the floodwater back toward the bank, the mule protesting mutely at every step. The black water was up to her chest now, and Charlie, frightened, lifted his muzzle and tried to half-leap forward. Another surge of water hit them, and as everything rushed around her, she felt his legs lift and was filled with sudden terror, as if the ground would surely slip away from them all for good. But just as she thought they too would be carried away, she felt her feet touch the ground again, knew Charlie's had done the same, and she felt him take another tentative step forward.
You okay, William?
I'm here.
Good boy, Charlie. Come on, boy.
Time slowed. They seemed to move forward in inches. She had no idea what was underneath. A solitary wooden drawer of neatly folded clothing floated by in front of them, followed by another, and then a small dead dog. She noted them only with some distant part of her brain. The black water had become a living, breathing thing. It snatched and pulled at her coat, blocking progress, demanding submission. It was relentless, deafening, and made fear rise like iron in her throat. Marjorie was now blue with cold, her skin pressed against Charlie's chestnut neck, her head bumping against William's great arms, all consciousness reduced to one thing.
Just get me home, boy, please. One step. Two.
You okay there, Marjorie?
She felt William's great hand on her arm, gripping her, and was unsure whether it was for his security or her own. The world had receded until it was just her and William and the mule, the roar in her ears, William's voice murmuring a prayer she couldn't make out, Charlie straining valiantly against the water, his body buffeted by a force he didn't understand, the ground slipping and sliding away from him every few steps, then again. A log whooshed past them, too big, too fast. Her eyes stung, filled with grit and water. She was dimly aware of Sophia reaching forward from the bank, her hand outstretched as if she could haul the three of them up by force. Voices joined hers from the bank. A man. More men. She could no longer see through the water in her eyes. She could think about nothing, her fingers, now numb, wound into Charlie's short mane, her other hand on his bridle. Six more steps. Four more steps. A yard. Please. 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 And then the mule lurched forward and upward, and she could feel strong hands reaching for her, pulling at her shoulders, her sleeves, her body a landed fish, William's shaking voice,
"Thank you, Lord, thank you."
Marjorie, feeling the river reluctantly relinquish its grip, uttered the same words silently through frozen lips. Her clenched fist, Charlie's hair still woven through her fingers, moved unthinkingly to her belly. And then everything went black. Chapter 17. Beth heard the girls before she saw them, their voices high above the roar of the water, childish and shrill. They clung to the front of a ramshackle cabin, their feet ankle-deep in water, and yelling at her,
"Miss! Miss!"
She tried to recall the family name, McCarthy, McAllister, and urged her horse across the water, but Scooter, already spooked by the strange electric atmosphere of the air and the dense, punishing rain, had made it partway across the swollen creek, then half-reared and spun away so that she almost fell off. She righted herself, but he would not be moved, snorting and running backward until his brain was so addled she feared he would do himself an injury. Cursing, Beth had dismounted, thrown his reins over a pole, and waded across the water toward them. They were young, the youngest maybe two at most, and clad in thin cotton dresses that clung to their pale skin. As she approached, they clamored for her. Six little anemone arms, reaching, waving. She got to them just before the surge. A rush of black water so fast and hard that she had to grab the baby around her middle to stop her being carried away. And then, there she was. Three small children huddled around her, gripping her coat, her voice making reassuring noises, even as her brain raced to work out how in hell she was going to make her way out of this one.
"Is anyone in the house?"
she yelled at the eldest, trying to be heard above the torrent. The child shook her head. Well, that's something, she thought, pushing away visions of